Good afternoon, listeners and students of Hitler's Table Talk. I'm Carolyn Yeager, and my partner is Ray Goodwin. He is not here right at the moment because we've just had some surprising news from Blog Talk, and I was not able to add him to the Skype call, but he's going to be calling in by telephone very shortly. I'm watching here for his call to come in. We're at episode 23 in our weekly reading of this written record of lunch and dinner table talks of the German Führer, beginning in July 1941 and going until 1944, when they were recorded more sporadically. Now we're in January 1942, and the subjects Hitler expounds upon just get more and more fascinating. And I don't think I told you that today is August 14th, 2014. We're ready to go, but I'm waiting for Ray to call. I hope he doesn't have any trouble calling in, but I don't want to spend too much time here in the beginning. I think I'll just start myself, and so I won't, wait for him to join us, which I hope he can do. We're starting on the night of the 26th January 1942. And on the 26th of January was the first American forces arrive in Europe, landing in Northern Ireland. And I think I may have read this last week, but the United States had joined the war in December 1941, so they finally got some forces on European soil and in Northern Ireland. So that's that. Now, Hitler's going to go talk more about dogs. And in this next section, I think I'll read the topic list here to give you an idea of what's going to be talked about, because he goes from one thing to another. More about dogs, origins of the human race, beauty and the ancient Greeks, the significance of mythology, thoughts on the prehistoric, then the cosmic theories of Horbiger, and human genius in politics. So there's quite a lot of interesting topics in this first section, and it's pretty long. So I will start reading. I'm just going to check one more time to see if I have a message from Ray, but maybe he's trying to do something. 323-642-1206. All right, that's our phone. That's our guest call-in number. I haven't gotten a Skype message from him to tell me that if he's having trouble or what kind of trouble it is. So I'll just continue here. So Hitler says, "I love animals, and especially dogs, but I'm not so very fond of boxers, for example. If I had to take a new dog, it could only be a sheepdog, preferably a bitch. I would feel like a traitor if I became attached to a dog of any other breed. What extraordinary animals they are. Lively, loyal, bold, courageous, and handsome. Well, I figured by picking out these particular adjectives for the dog, describe a good dog, or qualities that he likes. And he likes, if you know Hitler, you know he likes lively people. He likes witty people. He likes to be around people that are fun and are good observers of the world around them. And, of course, he values loyalty very highly, and he values boldness and courage. And, obviously, he likes things that are good-looking. Well, we can tell that from his advocacy of or approval of the SS and the kind of men that they wanted to have in the SS. Of course, he didn't have to be handsome, but a lot of them were particularly handsome, but they all had all these qualities. Well, here's the call. Okay, let's see. How do I answer this call here? Hello, Ray. Are you there?
Hey, Carolyn. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can hear you. Boy,
good,
you don't
good.
Sound quite as, you sound clear and fine, but you don't sound quite as good as you do on Skype, I'll say that.
Well, it's, this is my landline here, and I finally was able to get through.
Wow, was it hard to get through?
Well, I was trying to find it on the computer where to click in on the site and call you once I got that clicked in. I gave up on that. I just used that phone number and it rang through, so hey, maybe
right.
We got it going now.
Well, I explained what happened to the listeners, so I don't want to spend any more time.
Okay.
I have started, and I have read the first paragraph about I Love Animals. So if you would pick up from there, Ray, with the blind man's dog.
Okay. The blind man's dog is one of the most touching things in existence. He's more attached to his master than to any other dog. If he allows a bitch to distract his attention for a moment, it's for hardly any time, and he has a bad conscience. With bitches, it's more difficult. When they're on heat, they can't be restrained. During the winter of 1921-22, I was offered a sheepdog. He was so sad at the thought of his old master that he couldn't get accustomed to me. I therefore decided to part with him. His new master had gone a few steps when he gave him the slip and took refuge with me, putting his paws on my shoulders, so I kept him. When Graf made me a present of Mook, the process of getting accustomed was quicker. He came up the stairs rather hesitantly. When he saw Blondie, he rushed towards her, wagging his tail. Next day, it was indescribable. A dog gets used to a new master more quickly when there's already a dog in the house. It's enough even if he learns from the scent that his new master has recently had a dog. He feels himself trusted. The dog is the oldest of the domestic animals. He has been man's companion for more than 30,000 years. But man, in his pride, is not capable of perceiving that even between dogs of the same breed, there are extraordinary differences. There are stupid dogs and others who are so intelligent that it's agonizing.
Well, boy, that's really true, isn't it?
Yeah.
I've had both kind of dogs and been around both kind, and they're stupid dogs are not a pleasure to have.
Yeah.
And I always thought that stupid dogs bark a lot. And they don't have to be so stupid. I had, my dog Polly was so intelligent. And when I first, when she first came around, she was with her little sister. They were just puppies. And they were both so cute. And the sister was a darling dog, beautiful dog. And she was sweet as can be. She wasn't stupid, but she wasn't smart like Polly. And she didn't. She was a lot more fearful, everything scared her, and she wanted to be safe, and she, was slow to do things. And for that reason, and she barked a lot. She would bark during the night. She didn't bark a lot, but if there are other dogs barking around or whatever, and I figured that was because she was more nervous, and she thought she needed to bark to ward off whatever might come and get her, and she was afraid to leave the property very much. She wouldn't want to go along because she just wanted to stay home. So, so I guess there's dogs that fit different people. I found another home for her because we went away, and they were real nice lady who had a fenced in backyard and another dog. And I was in touch with her for a while, and she said that Ginger just seemed to be very happy there and was telling the other dog how to behave right and so on. She was happy in that situation.
Yeah.
Well, she had that fence around her.
Sure.
Okay. I'm sorry I went off on that like that.
No, that's all right. I appreciate the comments because, I was born and raised here in Texas, and small rural town, we always had a dog in the family, and then I grew up with them. I got in college, and I got my own little dog, and it was a dachshund, and that was the smartest little rascal, he lived to be 14 or so, 15, and then, a miniature schnauzer was the smartest dog I ever had in my life, and Hitler says here, there are stupid dogs and others who are so intelligent that it's agonizing. And my little miniature schnauzer was in that latter category. He was astonishing. Anyway, I appreciate all his words on this.
What's the difference between a schnauzer and a dachshund? Big difference, I suppose. What is it?
Just an entirely different breed. The little dachshund, he's a weenie dog, short-legged. and all. And the miniature schnauzer, of course, is taller and looks kind of like a wire-haired terrier a bit.
Oh, that's right. Okay, I'm picturing it now. Are they German too, the schnauzer?
Yes. Yes, schnauzer.
Okay. Yeah.
And Dachshund. So they're both German breeds.
Yeah, okay.
All right. I once possessed a work on the origins of the human race. I used to think a lot about such matters, and I must say that if one examines the old traditions, the tales and legends, from close up, one arrives at unexpected conclusions. It's striking to realize what a limited view we have of the past. The oldest specimens of handwriting we possess go back 3,000 or 4,000 years at most. No legend would have reached us if those who made and transmitted them hadn't been people like ourselves. Where do we acquire the right to believe that man has not always been what he is now? The study of nature teaches us that in the animal kingdom, just as much as in the vegetable kingdom, variations have occurred. They've occurred within the species, but none of these variations has an importance comparable to that which separates man from the monkey, assuming that this transformation really took place. If we consider the ancient Greeks, who were Germanics, we find in them a beauty much superior to the beauty such as is widespread today. And I mean also beauty in the realm of thought as much as in the realm of forms. To realize this, it's enough to compare a head of Zeus or a Pallas Athene with that of a crusader or a saint. If one plunges further into the past, one comes again with the Egyptians upon human beings of the quality of the Greeks. Since the birth of Christ, we have had scarcely 40 successive generations on the globe, and our knowledge goes back only a few thousand years before the Christian era. Legend cannot be extracted from the void. It couldn't be a purely gratuitous figment. Nothing prevents us from supposing, and I believe even that it would be to our interest to do so, that mythology is a reflection of things that have existed and of which humanity has retained a vague memory. And I want to stop right there and offer a comment. I have always felt that way. Any study of mythology, I always felt there. This wasn't just fantastic tales, that there was a basis for these things. And oftentimes it was more apparent than people like to believe. You know, they think it's just myths and stories. But I feel just as he does that humanity has retained a vague memory of those things.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it seems likely to me, too.
In all the human traditions, whether oral or written, one finds mention of a huge cosmic disaster. What the Bible tells on the subject is not peculiar to the Jews, but was certainly borrowed by them from the Babylonians and the Assyrians. In the Nordic legend, we read of a struggle between giants and gods. In my view, the thing is explicable only by the hypothesis of a disaster that completely destroyed a humanity which already possessed a high degree of civilization. The fragments of our prehistory are perhaps merely reproductions of objects belonging to a more distant past, and it's by means of these, doubtless, that the road to civilization was discovered anew. What is there to prove to us that the stone axe we rediscover in our parts was really an invention of those who used it? It seems to me more likely that this object is a reproduction in stone of an axe that previously existed in some other material. What proof have we, by the way, that beside objects made of stone, there were not similar objects made of metal? The life of bronze is limited, and that would explain that in certain earthy deposits one finds only objects made of stone. Moreover, there's no proof that the civilization that existed before the disaster flourished precisely in our regions. 3/4 of the earth are covered by water, and only 1/8 of the earth's surface is in practice accessible. Who knows what discoveries would be made if we could explore the ground that is at present covered by the waters. I'm quite well inclined to accept the cosmic theories of Horbiger. It's not impossible, in fact, that 10,000 years before our era, there was a clash between the earth and the moon that gave the moon its present orbit. It's likewise possible that the Earth attracted to it the atmosphere, which was that of the moon, and that this radically transformed the conditions of life on our planet. One can imagine that before this accident, man could live at any altitude, for the simple reason that he was not subject to the constraint of atmospheric pressure. One may also imagine that the Earth having opened, water rushed into the breach thus formed, and explosions followed, and then diluvian torrents of rain, from which human couples could escape only by taking refuge in very high regions. It seems to me that these questions will be capable of solution on the day when a man will intuitively establish the connection between these facts, thus teaching exact science the path to follow. Otherwise, we shall never raise the veil between our present world and that which preceded us.
If one I think there's a little delay there. It's not like it was on Skype, but when I break in, you don't hear me right away. But I didn't look up this Horbiger. I never thought about it at the time, but I just now looked him up and found out that he is a Austrian engineer from Vienna. He lived from 1931, excuse me. So obviously Hitler was looking into his things, and maybe there were art, you know, maybe he was in the news sometimes. But this is already 42, but he's remembering maybe things he read about him before. You know, his memory was so great. This Horbiger invented a new type of valve for compressors, but he is also remembered for his pseudoscientific world ice theory. Ice theory. Does that sound like it has anything to do with what you just read?
Are you saying world ICE theory?
Yes.
Yeah.
Ice. Okay. Uh-huh. Well, that's what he's. That's what Hitler's referring to.
Yeah, and I think that's the glaciers receding and coming down and causing an ice age. I think what he's talking about and how that affects civilization.
Oh yeah. All right. Because I was looking this up, and I wasn't paying as close of attention while you were reading it. Mm-hmm. All right. Well, there you go.
All righty. If one takes our religions at their beginning, one discovers in them a more human character than they subsequently acquired. I suppose religions find their origin in these faded images of another world of which human memory had retained the distant image. The human mind has needed such images, and that's spelled K-N-E-A-D-E-D, needed such images together with notions elaborated by the intelligence. And it's thus that the churches have created the ideological framework that today still ensures their power. The period stretching between the middle of the 3rd and the middle of the 17th century is certainly the worst humanity has ever known. Bloodlust, ignominy, lies. I don't consider that what has been should necessarily exist for the simple reason that it has been. Providence has endowed man with intelligence precisely to enable him to act with discernment. My discernment tells me that an end must be put to the reign of lies. It likewise tells me that the moment is not opportune. To avoid making myself an accomplice to the lies, I've kept the shavelings out of the party. I'm not afraid of the struggle. It will take place if really we must go so far. And I shall make up my mind to it as soon as I think it possible.
Well, if I might make a comment here,
yes,
or two,
good.
You know, just reminding people that when he mentions the shavelings, he means monks, priests, or Christian clergy. They were the ones, the monks always shaved their heads. The Christian priests don't, but anyway, that's what he calls them. Up above, where he, I missed here where he had said, when a man will intuitively establish the connection between these facts, and I, you know, it's, I believe a lot in intuition, and he also did. And, you know, intuition is just another form of genius, because in genius is when you come up with an idea that's considered like genius, it's because there's not really that much basis for it, but you have intuitively put some things together that hadn't been, that, you know, you didn't know from outside, from observation, objectively or whatever. But, and this is what happens in, intuition shouldn't be made fun of, because it's the way that we make progress, really. Most everybody that is like inventors and so on, they come upon, they're thinking, but finally intuitively something comes to them. Interesting, I think. So.
Oh, absolutely. And the word, you know, I want to bounce this off of you, see what you think of this. I had a class years ago, and the professor was talking about instinctive behavior. And he said, man has no instinctive behavior. Only animals have behaved by instinct. And, boy, that was a brick in my wall, because I've always felt like man was gifted with instinct as well as the animals. And this is where, to me, intuition is very akin to that. And I think that intuition that somebody has about something is a result of something implanted in their genes centuries or eons ago. And
it's just my own
thought and opinion, but I feel like man definitely has some instincts that warn him about danger and things such as that.
Well, you know, this professor or teacher didn't put it right, because we have instinct, but we also have rational thinking in the frontal brain and so on. The animals don't have that, so they depend on their instinct, and they're a lot more attuned to it and sensitive to it, whereas we often reject our instinctive ideas, and we reject our intuitions, too.
I agree.
Because our rational brain is not seeing it, and we don't see any evidence for it in the way that we're used to. So, we've got it all, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's against my own inclinations that I devoted myself to politics. I don't see anything in politics anyway but a means to an end. Some people suppose it would deeply grieve me to give up the activity that occupies me at this moment. They are deeply mistaken, for the finest day of my life will be that on which I leave politics behind me with its griefs and torments. When the war is over and I have the sense of having accomplished my duties, I shall retire. Then I would like to devote 5 or 10 years to clarifying my thought and setting it down on paper. Wars pass by. The only things that exist are the works of human genius. This is the explanation of my love of art, music, and architecture. Is it not in these disciplines that we find recorded the path of humanity's ascent? When I hear Wagner, it seems to me that I hear rhythms of a bygone world. I imagine to myself that one day science will discover, in the waves set in motion by the Rheingold, secret mutual relations connected with the order of the world. The observation of the world perceived by the senses precedes the knowledge given by exact science as well as by philosophy. It's in as far as percipient awareness approaches truth that it has value. There's a lot said right there.
Boy, I guess so. You know, and isn't he saying that only truth has value?
Well, I was just going to say, he says, it's in as far as percipient awareness approaches truth that it has value. Otherwise, this so-called percipient awareness has no value. And that's, to me, that's connected with when he said the observation of the world perceived by the senses precedes that by knowledge, you know, by exact
science
and philosophy.
Yeah, by science. Well, you know, we used to perceive everything by the senses.
Yes.
And then we developed science, which told us a lot of things that we couldn't understand through our senses, parent, you know, except some more advanced people understood things better. But and then he adds philosophy. But yes, this is, you know, Hitler. Hitler could have been almost anything. He could have gone into almost any field, I suppose, and done well. And he liked he certainly liked thinking about all these things. And it his idea of thinking about his retirement already was nothing new here in Table Talk. He talked about it in other places too. And certainly he was already kind of I don't want to say weary, but he was mm-hmm. he was sorry that he was involved in this war. I don't want to put that's not the right way to put it. You know, waging war was not what he really wanted to do.
that's
a better way to put it. And
well,
he was sorry that he couldn't be devoting his time to the things he loved and cared about. But he's going to say some more things. Has he said this yet? I guess not, about how he needs to serve the German people. That's coming up.
Yeah, that's coming up.
Okay.
But, you know, it's the war, I think in his mind, he detested it because it got in the way of the good things that he had in mind for his nation and his people. And this war was an unfortunate thing imposed upon him from the outside. And what it has done is delay and detract from what his original goals were. And
they
you know,
were
that's
building.
Why.
He wanted to build. He wanted
Correct.
To build all these beautiful, wonderful things for Germany, because he didn't think that those who came after him might not be able to do it, might not have the vision that he had, and he thought he had it, and he wanted to see it put in, you know, he wanted to do it, and he was not able to. He got a lot of designs made, but most of it never got built.
Yes, and you know, his observations
of
the great civilizations, you know, the Greeks, what survived those great civilizations, such as Rome and Greece,
mm-hmm.
were their buildings, their architecture,
mm-hmm.
the Parthenon and things like this, and they were remnants of what was once a great civilization. And I think he could foresee down the line that if he could institute building some magnificent things in Germany, whether that was to do with farming or industry or housing or whatever, that those would prove the test of time and be evidence way down the line somewhere that Germany had indeed greatness.
Sure. Yes, he's going to leave that for mm-hmm. the coming generations and so on. And, he wanted them to be built. And Albert Speer later on made fun of this, but he wasn't making fun of it during the time that he and Hitler were involved in it. He wanted to build for the long term. He wanted to build things of stone so they
That's
would
right.
last, just like the Roman buildings lasted.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
And so, you know, that's part of the tragedy, that was not able to be done.
That's right.
But anyway, let's see what else he says.
Okay. The notion that the cosmos is infinite in all senses should be expressed in an accessible fashion. It is infinite in the sense of the infinitely great, as well as in the sense of the infinitely small. It would have been a mistake at the beginning of the positivist era to picture space as limited by the bounds perceived by the instruments. We should reason in the same fashion today, despite the progress made in methods of measurement, and that applies both on the microscopic and also on the macroscopic scale. Seen in the microscope, a microbe acquires gigantic proportions. In this direction, too, there is no end. If somebody else had one day been found to accomplish the work to which I've devoted myself, I would never have entered on the path of politics. I'd have chosen the arts or philosophy. The care I feel for the existence of the German people compelled me to this activity. It's only when the conditions for living are assured that culture can blossom.
Well, that's where he said that, and that's just excellent. And I
yes.
think he's 100% or 200% sincere in what he's saying here, and he's revealing every, you know, what he really feels and thinks.
Right.
And you just can't figure from this that he's some kind of a fake, or how people can think that he was a traitor, that he was really working for, you know, someone else working for the Jews, or working for the British, working for the Soviet Union, or, I mean, it's just nuts. You know, you can't make this kind of thing up. He'd never be talking like this. And this is also so much him. So that people who are saying, this whole book is a fake. I've been running into, this came up again this week, Ray, with some people talking about it. And I guess there's a site I was told about, a website called truthforgermans.com. You know that Truth, Justice for Germans, that was so popular, quit functioning. I don't know, still there, I guess, but there's nobody running it. And now some people have put together Truth for Germans, and they've got some blog pages, and they're very long, on why Table Talk is a fake, and things about, mostly it's geared for Hitler being a Christian, and Germany being a totally Christian nation, and National Socialist Germany being Christian, and so on. And there's no person's name on it. It's totally anonymous, the whole thing. But here, this just came up. I just came to my mind because here, you know, what Hitler is saying here in throughout the book, but in a place like this especially, I mean, it's so much identified with him. And the way he talked with other people at other times, especially with friends and in close, you know, amongst people he trusted. And I don't think, I guess there's people can make up anything. They could take it from all these other sources and put it together and say he said it here. But he's saying the same thing that he said in other times and other places.
Mm-hmm.
So there's no reason to say that he doesn't mean what he's saying.
Right. And this particular section that we just finished, his philosophizing, he's talking about animals and creation and things like this, and saying that he would have never even gotten into politics and would get out of it if someone could take his place. That also, you know, flies in the face of all the demonizing of him and the accusations of megalomania about him. Anybody that is that kind of personality that the history books say about him today, that so-called documentaries on television say, anybody who was that way, truly that way, could never talk in this manner, could never say things of the senses and feeling that he does. And, you know, so it destroys the image that everybody's supposed to have of Adolf Hitler.
Well, that's
his
very
own words,
well put.
Right,
and you know, he really was convinced that he was chosen. He didn't want to get carried away with it, you know, and talk about it like that. But he was convinced that he was the one who could do for Germany what Germany needed, and he certainly proved that in the beginning. He did it all along, up until wartime, and then you have a lot of people criticizing how he conducted the war. But the war was very, very difficult. He had his ideas. Other people had their ideas based on more traditional military theory or something. And I just don't know. I can't say that he was a perfect commander-in-chief of the... But I don't know that anybody else would have done any better or would have come out with a different outcome, you know, even as far as the number of Germans who were killed. Because when those Germans weren't killed in battle, and if they surrendered, or they even if after the war they were killed in those camps, died in those camps, there's one way or another they were going to get rid of all those German men. It seems
That's
to me
right.
There it's better to die fighting. At least some of them have that heroic memory, or their families do, and they have some medals and so on.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know, but it's okay. This was a nice section here. And now we're going to go, he's going to talk about women. What is the date of this? Because I don't have it online. And I have to disagree just slightly, not very much. But he's, I don't really disagree, but he's a little bit sure of himself.
this one he does come out pretty forcefully. But, you know, it's always...
I don't have a date.
It's 26th January, 1942, evening.
Evening. Okay, thanks.
Yeah, 26th of January, 1942, in the evening. He starts this section off by saying, I detest women who dabble in politics, and if their dabbling extends to military matters, it becomes utterly unendurable. In no local section of the party has a woman ever had the right to hold even the smallest post. It has therefore often been said that we were a party of misogynists who regarded a woman only as a machine for making children or else as a plaything. That's far from being the case. I attached a lot of importance to women in the field of the training of youth and that of good works. In 1924, we had a sudden upsurge of women who were attracted by politics. Frau von Truenfels and Mathilde von Chemnitz, they wanted to join the Reichstag in order to raise the moral level of that body, so they said. I told them that 90% of the matters dealt with by Parliament were masculine affairs, on which they could not have opinions of any value. They rebelled against this point of view, but I shut their mouths by saying, you will not claim that you know men as I know women. A man who shouts is not a handsome sight. But if it's a woman, it's terribly shocking. The more she uses her lungs, the more strident her voice becomes. There she is, ready to pull hair out with all her claws showing. In short, gallantry forbids one to give women an opportunity of putting themselves in situations that do not suit them. Everything that entails combat is exclusively men's business. There are so many other fields in which one must rely upon women. Organizing a house, for example. Few men have Frau Truss' talent in matters concerning interior decoration. There were four women whom I give star roles: Frau Truss, Frau Wagner, Frau Schultz-Klink, and Leni Riefenstahl. The Americans are
admirable. Well, wait a minute. Hold on.
Yeah, it's a good place to stop.
He says there's so many other fields that one must rely on women, like organizing a house. I mean, that's kind of a down, a letdown there. You know, people are listening. Oh, well, what are we supposed to be doing? Oh, organizing a house. Well, what if you don't have much of a house to organize? Not all women had that very nice houses. So, I don't mean to pick up. Most of the time I can't argue one little bit, nor would I want to, because he makes a lot of sense.
My own thought right there, Carolyn, is that falls back on his tremendous, I guess you could say, respect and appreciation for women as the bearers of the generations to come, and that if the family is going to survive and the children are going to be brought up in the right way, the key to that is the female.
And then the whole thing. I mean, the Third Reich was a society to admire, and mm-hmm. this was the way it was organized. So you can't really complain, you can't really disagree with it because
sure.
it worked. It worked,
right.
and women who really didn't want to, who really pushed to do something, they weren't stopped from it. There were no laws against it. Well, there were some laws that only men could do this or that or anything, but nobody really bothered with that, and German men were gallant toward women. Now, in the old, when Hitler was growing up, there was a lot of domestic abuse in families and so on, because the people lived in such bad conditions, and nobody, men would be out of work and so on. But after he was able to take over and improve the economy and improve the working conditions and improved everything, then whatever it was that I said before, there was no women were treated quite well.
Mm-hmm. And you know that his firm belief in meritocracy did not stop with the sex line. You know, the best should be in that office. The best should have that job. The talent should be allowed to come to the fore. That applied to the women as well as the men under National Socialism.
It really did. It did. Because everybody wanted the best people to be doing things, yeah. Okay, so we need to move
on. The Americans are admirable at mass production when it's a question of producing a single model repeated without variation in a great number of copies. That's lucky for us, for their tanks are proving unusable. We could wish them to build another 60,000 this year. I don't believe in miracles, and I'm convinced that when they come along with their 28-tonners and 60-tonners, the smallest of our tanks will outclass them. They have some people there who sent, and that's S-C-E-N-T, an economic crisis far surpassing that of 1929. When one has no substitute product for materials like copper, for example, one is soon at the end of one's tether. So anyway, that was just
What do you say to what he said about that our smaller tanks will outclass even their 28 and 60 tonners?
Well,
was he bragging too much there or expecting too much?
No, I think at that particular time, he was hitting the nail on the head because the early tanks that the American military had were deficient in a lot of ways, and it's like they hadn't the technology was lagging and whatever, and our tanks were not superior in performing, but they were on the way because, you know, military technology, there always are, any kind of technology is always digging for a better way to improve the firepower, the instrumentation, the horsepower, the treads, and things like this, and it was coming. And he says, I doubt they'll ever make it. Well, that was a mistake because the tanks that were produced later in the war were much more capable than the ones that they were using in early in the war in 1942.
Well, better than the German tanks?
No,
any point,
they weren't.
Did they ever get better than the German tanks? What was the best
later,
tank? Was it the Sherman tank?
Yeah, and it was for its size and all was a pretty good tank. He stresses size here. You know, 28 tonners and 60 tonners, which were huge giants, the toughest, the most successful, and the best of the biggest tanks belonged to the Soviets, and
mm-hmm.
The Russians had a lot of trouble dealing with them. And the American technology came along quicker than he would have expected because the guys on the front using those weapons were saying, hey, you know, this thing is like a mosquito sting to the things over here. We need more firepower. We need this. We need that. And
yeah,
all
when
along,
there's motivation and need, well, then a genius gets to work, and they come up with
something. Yeah, that's right. That's right. So, anyway.
Okay, we're moving on to the next date, and I have a timeline for January 27th. The British withdraw all troops back into Singapore. So what was going on there? They were having a setback? They withdrew all their troops back into Singapore.
Yes, the Japanese were pushing them all over, and it's kind of like the Americans in the Philippines that withdrew all the way everybody to Corregidor, you know, that hadn't already been captured. And it was kind of a last bastion, a holdout. Well, Singapore was that way for the British.
Okay.
And they backed in. Their military was being pushed from everywhere, retreating, and they backed into Singapore, and then that eventually fell. Okay, 27th January, 1942, midday, special guest, Himmler. The soldiers whom England used for her wars were, for the most part, men of German blood. The first great outpouring of blood that could properly be described as English took place in the First World War. And how one understands that that ordeal left its mark on them.
So, you know, now so it's 1942. Excuse me, Ray. It's 1942, yep. And he's already calling the First World, the Great War, the First World War. So I guess the current war is already being called the Second World War?
Yes, that's right.
What do you think? Was it?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. I didn't wonder when they decided to call it that.
That's a very interesting question, and I would be guessing here, but I think it was, you know, that the initial fighting began in September 3rd, 1939, if I'm not mistaken, September 1st or 3rd. Mm-hmm. And then as it grew into 1940, and there was that lull, and then it began heating up again, and then when the Japanese attacked Pearl, and much more of the world got into it, then it started to be recognized as kind of a worldwide conflict.
Yeah, but that was very, very recent, because we're in January 42.
Right.
That was in December 41, so it had just, so I thought it was a little bit surprised that he said the first World War.
Mm-hmm.
But so he's all, this one, he's recognizing that this is, of course, it has to be considered a world war at this point. Just about everybody's involved in it. But
that's
he's
right.
Calling it that. But it's not like a formal world war. It's the first is lowercase, and then world war is in caps.
Yes, that's right.
Okay, well, I'm talking a lot tonight. I probably should.
Oh, that's fine. That's fine. And, you know, he's talking about the British or English. Those who fought for England were, for the most part, men of German blood, and he said he was remarking about how one understands that ordeal left its mark on them, meaning World War One, the British soldiers. So as not to suffer the after effects of the present war on the economic level, the English should have abandoned their capitalistic system, or else shaken off the burden of a debt that was reaching $1,400,000. They made a timid attempt in that direction by the classic method, by reducing their armaments budget to a minimum so as to be able thus to pay the interest on their debt. Their situation after the Napoleonic Wars was somewhat similar to that of after 1918. They passed through a long period of exhaustion, didn't become themselves again until under Victoria's reign. A people cannot lay claim to mastery of the world unless it's ready to pay with its blood. The Roman Empire had recourse to mercenaries only when its own blood was exhausted. In fact, it was only after the Third Punic War that Rome had legions of mercenaries. But for the coming of Christianity, who knows how the history of Europe would have developed. Rome would have conquered all Europe, and the onrush of the Huns would have been broken on the legions. It was Christianity that brought about the fall of Rome, not the Germans or the Huns. What Bolshevism?
Well, before we go into the Christianity thing, I just wanted to comment here on this: a people cannot lay claim to mastery of the world unless it's ready to pay with its blood. And you know, to me, this is him again saying that if we Germans want to master these areas that we're fighting in, and we want to be masters. There, I'm going to playing around with the master race here, but they're not. They did want to be in control. So that's one reason why he wanted. I could say maybe that he wanted Germans to fight and win, and he wanted the Germans because he wanted Germans to rule afterwards. He didn't want to have a whole bunch of others fighting for Germany. He wanted the Germans to fight, and he says that unless you shed your own blood, you can't lay claim to, I suppose, the fruits of victory, so to speak.
Well, I think
that just stood out to me.
That has merit, very much so. Originally, when I read this passage, I thought it was just a direct slap at the British. You know, he's talking about the British using mostly English, German blood soldiers, and that the British Empire claiming so much surface of the world's surface and control over, and he says a people cannot lay claim to mastery of the world, which the British seem to do, unless it's ready to pay with its blood. So I think he was questioning Britain's gumption or you know, their want to fight for that empire. Did they really have enough guts to extend themselves? And mm-hmm. I took it as a kind of a slap at the British,
yeah.
and saying they're not gonna come out on top on this unless they're ready to give their all.
So, well, I think you're right.
And certainly it applies, as you said, to if Germany's going to do that, they got to be. It's going to be a hell of a sacrifice.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay. Now, going into the Christianity. This is fascinating here. I think this is good stuff, where he says, but for the coming of Christianity, who knows how the history of Europe would have developed? Rome would have conquered all of Europe, and the onrush of the Huns would have been broken on the legions. It was Christianity that brought about the fall of Rome, not the Germans or the Huns. What Bolshevism is achieving today on the materialist and technical level, Christianity had achieved on the metaphysical level. When the crown sees the throne totter, it needs the support of the masses. It would be better to speak of Constantine the traitor and Julian the loyal than of Constantine the great and Julian the apostate. What the Christians wrote against the Emperor Julian is approximately of the same caliber as what the Jews have written against us. The writings of the Emperor Julian, on the other hand, are products of the highest wisdom. If humanity took the trouble to study and understand history, the resulting consequences would have incalculable implications. One day, ceremonies of thanksgiving will be sung to fascism and National Socialism for having preserved Europe from a repetition of the triumph of the underworld.
Well, now, I want to say here... that once again, he's really thinks highly of Julian the Apostate. He read about him, and ever since then, he liked him a lot. He was very impressed. And I thought it was interesting that he says, what the Christians wrote against the Emperor Julian, who he says is a very, very wise man, is the same caliber as what the Jews have written against us. Boy, that's a strong statement.
Mm-hmm.
If I ever read one. So yeah. That's a real put down of the Christians, I must say, because they didn't seem to appreciate this emperor because they wanted to bring down the empire.
Right.
Right? Yeah.
Right.
I take it.
Well, and the way he ends up, where that paragraph ends up, and him saying that one of these days ceremonies of thanksgiving are going to be sung to fascism and National Socialism for having preserved Europe from a repetition of the triumph of the underworld. And to me, what he's previously said to that says the triumph of the underworld centuries ago was due to the fact of Christianity and these people who felt, Constantine was great, Julian the apostate, and things like that. And it was those people who, I guess you could say, you could lay the blame on, or certainly say they had a lot to do with Europe going under and entering the Dark Ages. And so there was nothing like today's, for him, fascism and National Socialism is preserving Europe from a repetition of that collapse. And so, I mean, that's to me, that's mm-hmm. what he's saying.
Well, I believe that was his belief. Absolutely,
yeah.
Firm belief. Yeah.
Yeah, and going on, he says, that's a danger that especially threatens England. The conservatives would face a terrible ordeal if the proletarian masses were to seize power. If Chamberlain, on his return from Munich, had based elections on the choice between war and peace, he'd have obtained a crushing majority in favor of peace. When I took possession of Memel, Chamberlain informed me through a third party that he understood very well that this step had to be taken, even although he could not approve of it publicly. At this period, Chamberlain was being fiercely attacked by the Churchill clan. If he'd had the presence of mind to organize an election, he'd have been saved. In similar cases, I've always made arrangements for a plebiscite to be held. It produces an excellent effect, both at home and abroad. It wasn't at this juncture that the Labor Party could return into the lists. The Jews had set the cat among the pigeons. If Samuel Hoare were to come to power today, as is desirable, all he'd have to do would be to set free the fascist. The English have to settle certain social problems which are ripe to be settled. At present, these problems can still be solved from above in a reasonable manner. I tremble for them if they don't do it now, for if it's left to the people to take the initiative, the road is open to madness and destruction. Men like Mosley would have had no difficulty in solving the problem by finding a compromise between conservatism and socialism, by opening the road to the masses, but without depriving the elite of their rights.
Well, doesn't that seem like his solution?
Yeah. What he's saying, that England has this seething underworld or a mass of discontent.
Underclass.
Yeah, and it's going to erupt as in Bolshevism, as it did in Russia and the slaughter of the elite and things. And that he's, you know, what he's saying is they're sitting on a powder keg, and if they don't handle it right, it's going to blow them all to hell. And they could learn something by taking example from Italy and Germany.
Mm-hmm. Right, and that is one of the reasons he was compromising between socialism and conservatism, or he was bringing mm-hmm. together the upper classes and the lower classes and the middle classes and trying to make them all get something that they wanted, you know.
Yeah, I mean a national unity instead of tearing at each other's throats.
Right. Now, Samuel Hoare, he played an important role, but he's only mentioned here. But so I'll just quickly say he was a senior British conservative politician who served in various cabinet posts. But he was, from 1940 to 1944, he was British ambassador to Spain, and he played a role in the Hess undercover operation. He was looked upon as agreeable to Germany and kind of a friend, you know, somebody that they thought well of, but he was really functioning for the British elites who were doing this black ops stuff with the peace probes.
He goes on to say, class prejudices can't be maintained in a socially advanced state like ours, in which the proletariat produces men of such superiority. Every reasonably conducted organization is bound to favor the development of beings of worth. It has been my wish that the educative organizations of the party should enable the poorest child to lay claim to the highest functions if he has enough talent. The party must see to it, on the other hand, that society is not compartmentalized so that everyone can quickly assert his gifts. Otherwise, discontent raises its head, and the Jew finds himself in just the right situation to exploit it. It's essential that a balance should be struck in such a way that dyed-in-the-wool conservatives may be abolished, as well as Jewish and Bolshevik anarchists. The English people is composed of races that are very different from one another and have not been blended together as in many other countries. There lies the danger that amongst them a class war may be transformed into a racial war. The English could escape this risk by ceasing to judge their fellow citizens in accordance with their outward aspects and paying attention instead to their real qualities. One can be the son of a good family and have no talent. If the English behaved as we behave in the party, they would give advancement only to the most deserving. It's good that the professions should be organized, but on condition that each man finds his place. It's folly to have a man build roads who would be best would at best be capable of sweeping them, just as it is scandalous to make a road sweeper of a man who has the stuff of an engineer. National socialism has introduced into daily life the idea that one should choose an occupation because one is predisposed to it by one's aptitudes and not because one is predestined for it by birth. Thus, national socialism exercises a calming effect. It reconciles men instead of setting them against one another. It's ridiculous that a child should ever feel obliged to take up his father's profession. Only his aptitudes and gifts should be taken into consideration. Why shouldn't a child have propensities that his parents didn't have? Isn't everyone in Germany sprung from the peasantry? One must not put a curb on individuals. On the contrary, one must avoid whatever might prevent them from rising. If one systematically encourages the selection of the fittest, the time will come when talents will again be, in a sort of way, the privilege of an elite. I got this impression especially strongly on the occasion of the launching of the Tirpitz. The workers gathered for that ceremony gave an extraordinary impression of nobility.
Well, there he goes again, talking about how the workers, the working class,
yes,
looks better than some of the managerial class, you might
yeah,
say.
Yeah, the so-called dignitaries.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and they took, you know, those workers took such pride in what they had done too, and you know, it made them feel a part of something, a part of the state, you know, and so.
Yeah, well, that was the whole point of it, to make everybody,
yes,
make them feel.
Exactly.
You know, it's really shocking when Hitler tells those stories that before his time, even during Wilhelm II's time and earlier,
mm-hmm,
that what would you say, the wealthy class of Germany didn't feel that that the common German was even was a part of the same nation that they were. They didn't think, mm-hmm, they didn't give them any respect whatsoever. They didn't identify with them at all. They wouldn't identify with them.
Right.
And yet Hitler brought that about in a very short time when all that changed. I suppose that was the movement that was going on everywhere, though, so that didn't hurt, you know, that helped it, but it's pretty amazing to think that these people had these, and sometimes they were landed aristocrats, and they actually did believe that Germany belonged to them, that it was their job to rule it, and these other people, all these other Germans, weren't even really German the way they were, and didn't have,
mm-hmm,
any right to say anything about it.
Right.
Yeah, pretty different. Okay.
Evolution usually occurs in one direction, that is to say, in the direction of the development of intellectuality. One has a tendency to forget what the potential of energy to be found in the people means for the nation's life. For the maintenance of social order, excuse me, it's important that room should be found, not only for the intellect, but also for strength. Otherwise, the day comes when strength, having divorced the intellect, rebels against it and crushes it. The duel between intellect and strength will always be decided to the advantage of strength. A social class made up solely of intellectuals feels a sort of bad conscience. When a revolution occurs, this class is afraid to assert itself. It sits on its sacks of coin. It plays the coward. My own conscience is clean. If I'm told that somewhere there exists a young man who has talent, I myself will do what I can for him. Nothing could be more agreeable to me than to be told, when somebody is introduced to me, here's a man of rare talent. Perhaps one day he'll be the Führer of the nation. Precisely because I favor a maximum of equity in the established social order, for that very reason I feel myself entitled to rage with pitiless severity against whoever might try to undermine that order. the order I'm building must be solid enough to withstand all trials, and that's why we shall drown in blood any attempt to subvert that order. But in this National Socialist Society, nothing will be left undone to find their proper place for competence and talent. We really want every man to have his chance. Let those who have an aptitude for commanding command, and let the others be the agents who carry those commands out. It's important to appreciate, without prejudice, everyone's aptitudes and faults, so that everyone can occupy the place that suits him for the greatest good of the community. On the day when the English set free their 9,000 fascists, these men will tear the guts out of the plutocrats, and the problem will be solved. In my view, when there are 9,000 men in a country who are capable of facing prison from loyalty to an idea, this idea remains a living one. And as long as a man is left to carry the flag, nothing is lost. Faith moves mountains. In that respect, I see things with the coldest objectivity. If the German people lost its faith, if the German people were no longer inclined to give itself body and soul in order to survive, then the German people would have nothing to do but disappear. And that's exactly what you referred to a while ago, Carolyn, in that sentence about, are you willing to give your blood to see this thing through? So.
Yes. Yeah. And boy, I like where he says, I see this with the coldest objectivity.
Mm-hmm.
In this respect, I see things with the coldest objectivity. So there are areas where he knew was so true, and he was so certain that there was no room to doubt, and he wasn't going to be listened to anybody saying, oh, that's too hard or that's too harsh or something. That's what a real leader needs to be able to do.
Oh, yeah.
Obviously there were 9,000 so-called fascists that the English had in jail and prison at that time during the war to keep them out of circulation. It must have been about that number.
Mm-hmm, that's right. See, yeah. That was part of Mosley's bunch in England that protested against the war party. I call them the war party, Churchill and his bunch of Jewish bought and paid for traitors were directing war, and there was a chance to stop that war early on, and they wouldn't let it happen. And Mosley and his people were, of course, they were labeled as Nazis and pro-German and everything like this, when in actuality, sir, I know that very many of them actually were that, but they were also very pro-England, and they had a much more clear vision that England was going to get torn asunder if this foolishness went on, and the government had to shut those people down because there were others starting to listen to them and follow them, and 9,000 of them, yeah, went to prison for what they believed in, and that's why when Hitler says, hey, you know, if there's 9,000 people in a country capable of facing prison terms because of their loyalty to an idea, then that idea remains a living one, and he hit the nail on the head there. And it's just the same as in the United States when Roosevelt jailed all of his opposition, when Abraham Lincoln did the same thing in the war between the states.
I've got a timeline coming up of when that started.
Alrighty.
In the United States. But, you know, it's not for right now. And we're at the 27th of January in the evening. We have a fairly good lengthy one. It's 8:17, and you're also calling in on the telephone. So you tell me if you want to try to do this next section before we quit.
Yeah, I think we can. It's about total of about three pages, three
okay.
and a quarter, something like that. Yeah, I
All
think
right.
we can get it done. 27th of January, 1942, evening. America should be living in abundance, but rationalization is the beginning of an unspeakable poverty. The counterpart of this poverty is the insolent opulence of the privileged caste. Obviously, the Jew thinks as a capitalist and not as an economist. I believe the United States have promised Brazil to buy up its crop of coffee after the war. The Brazilians must have been lured in one way or another. States like Brazil should understand that such a policy will more and more drive Europe to autarky. Now, just to comment on that right there, I think what he's referring to there was the United States was putting pressure on Brazil to get away from its neutrality and to deny ports to German ships and things like this, and twisted their arm, and he says they must have promised Brazil they'd buy up their crop of coffee after the war. And that's what he's talking about in that instance.
Yeah.
Volcker made me the proposal in 1933 to supply us with 2 million tons.
Now, I'll just say this Albert Volcker, as best I can find out about him, is that he was president of the Kaiser Wilhelm Society, which was established in 1911 for the advancement of science. And so he had something to do with petrol, synthetic petrol.
Volcker made me the proposal in 1933 to supply us with 2 million tons of synthetic petrol in the space of 3 years on condition that we should undertake to buy his entire output at a price fixed beforehand for a period of 10 years. His offer covered our entire needs for the year 1934. The Ministry of Economics torpedoed the scheme. It was arranged in advance that the IG Farben would finance the construction of the factories. The scheme furthermore guaranteed employment for hundreds of thousands of workers. As a result of this piece of torpedoing, I sacked some high officials of the Ministry of Economics and I installed Kepler there. Thereupon, they tripped him up with the knave of Dusseldorf. And thus, another 9 months were wasted. Behind Schacht was Dieterding. I'd much like to know who wasn't corrupt in that bucket shop. These circumstances led me to set afoot the four-year plan, at the head of which I placed Goering. As regards Buna, that's B-U-N-A, there were the same kinds of resistance. Whatever I did, things didn't go forward. Things began to change at the Ministry of Economics when Funk took it in hand. It was only after the beginning of the winter of 1936 that I began to have something to say about the state railways. Until then, it was the clauses of the Treaty of Versailles that were operative. I canceled these clauses by a law that I had passed by the Reichstag so that no lawyer could come and argue with me about the illegality of the measures on which I decided. Thus, the state railways, the state bank, and the Kaiser Wilhelm Canal came back beneath our sovereignty. What troubles I had until the moment when I could regain the effective control of German affairs in their entirety. It's an imperative obligation for the white man in the colonies to keep the native at a distance. The Japanese haven't any transport problems to solve. Wherever they install themselves, they can live on the resources of the region. All they need is ammunition. The Americans, on the other hand, need a gigantic transport fleet. All the same, what happened wasn't inevitable. The English had a right to be cowards, but at least they had to be clever. A policy of friendship with us would have entailed their offering us Guinea, for example. Now, because of their stupidity, they're losing a whole world, and they've turned us into allies of the Japanese. What would have happened on the 13th March, 1936, if anybody other than myself had been at the head of the Reich? Anyone you care to mention would have lost his nerve. I was obliged to lie, and what saved us was my unshakable obstinacy and my amazing aplomb. I threatened, unless the situation eased in 24 hours, to send 6 extra divisions into the Rhineland. The fact was, I only had 4 brigades. The next day, the English newspapers wrote that there had been an easing of the international situation. I must recognize that Ribbentrop is not a particularly agreeable companion, but he's a sturdy and obstinate man. Neurath displayed the same qualities on that occasion. A retreat on our part would have spelt collapse. Our negotiators were in a situation similar to that of 1919. They could have obtained much more favorable peace conditions, But was it in the interest of the German people? That was quite another question. What did it matter, after all, to obtain an army of 200,000 or 300,000 men in place of the army of 100,000? What matters to a nation is to be free. And it was the German nation's despair that gave birth to National Socialism. We had a fundamental problem to deal with, and it's only after the event that one can say that a certain good could be born of evil. But it goes without saying that the task of a negotiator is to extract the best possible conditions from his adversary. Amongst the Social Democrats, there were men who favored an energetic policy and were willing to take the risks. It was two Catholics, Wirth and Erzberger, who gave in. I'm going to just say a note here about what we just talked about, Carolyn. This March 13th of 1936, was the German reoccupation of the Rhineland. And at the settlement in Versailles, that section had been deemed a DMZ, so to speak, demilitarized zone, and no German troops in it and all that. But it was occupied with the Allied soldiers for a few years before they left. And then when Hitler says, you know, that's part of who we are, that's our territory, we're going to march some troops in there, because as it stands right now, France had just signed a pact with Russia. And Germany saw that as a possible threat to them, that the French and the Russians could unite, and then that Rhineland unoccupied there would be a perfect alley or venue right into Germany. So send some troops in there and reoccupy it, and if the Allies don't like it, let's see what they do. And he exercised his courage, and that's when he said, I had to lie. I was obliged to lie by telling them that he had six more divisions to send in and everything. But it worked. It got German possession of that Rhineland. It got their troops back in there. And it was a tremendous coup for him, popularity-wise, with his people. But that's what he was talking about in all this stuff, about showing guts and stepping in.
That's right.
And he said, if we'd had an army of 200,000 or 300,000 men, the French army would not have degenerated as it did. That circumstance stood us in good stead. The French, having fallen into indolence, we recovered much more quickly than they did. The man who, without any doubt, will find himself justified by history is Lloyd George. In a memorandum drafted at the time, Lloyd George declared that if peace were made in the conditions foreseen, it would help to start a new war. And he's talking about Versailles there, David Lloyd George there. The Germans fought so heroically, he wrote, that this proud nation will never be content with such a peace. If Lloyd George had had the necessary power, he would certainly have been the architect of a German-English understanding. The British Navy was the chief partisan of such an understanding. It was the jumping jacks of politics, inspired by world Jewry, who set themselves against it. The sailors thought that the German fleet represented the necessary supplement to the British fleet to guarantee the policing of the seas. In a conflict of no interest to Europe, the German Navy would have had its mission to guard the safety of European waters, which would have set free the entirety of the British fleet. Events missed actually taking that direction only by a hair's breadth. The Jews must pack up, disappear from Europe, let them go to Russia. Where the Jews are concerned, I'm devoid of all sense of pity. They'll always be the ferment that moves people against the other. They sow discord everywhere, as much between individuals as between peoples. They'll also have to clear out of Switzerland and Sweden. It's where they're found to be in small numbers that they're most dangerous. Put 5,000 Jews in Sweden, soon they'll be holding all the posts there. Obviously, that makes them all the easier to spot. It's entirely natural that we should concern ourselves with the question on the European level. It's clearly not enough to expel them from Germany. We cannot allow them to retain the bases of withdrawal at our doors. We want to be out of danger of all kinds of infiltration. So, anyway.
Wow. Wow.
That's a lot said.
Well, it's interesting he added that. I don't know what brought him to say that, but maybe somebody, you know, we don't know what else is being said during this time. But somebody might have said, you know, sometimes people are trying to question if they were being too hard on the Jews or something. And he may have responded this way, well, we've got to get rid of them, and here's why. But here he makes it very clear what the plan is, to send them to Russia and have to get them out of all of Europe. And this,
yeah.
In spite of the fact that people want, some people want to make something out of his approving of Jews, part Jews in the military when their officers, when they were discovered that people had some Jewish background and they were serving in the military, that were officers, and their higher officers thought they were doing a good job and wanted to keep them, and he would approve of that. In spite of that, that doesn't mean that he had any softness for Jews generally, not only in Germany, but in Europe.
Right. And, you know, to me, he's kind of nostalgic and sad when he's talking about what could have been, about the unity between Germany and England with Lord George and the British Navy and the German Navy working together for the best of Europe. And he says, this almost happened. We came within a hair's breadth of happening, but who derailed it? And they, and that's why then he jumps on them. These people caused this. And he named who they were, too.
Yes. Yeah. Right. All right. So that's our ending. We thank you very much, Ray, for using the telephone tonight. We'll have to see what we're going to do about this situation. But okay, yeah. Ladies and gentlemen, thanks for listening. This is Hitler's Table Talk on August 14th, 2014. See you next week.